This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Politics and tax policy are never far apart, so the Bush tax cuts and the fall elections today. How the government's going to get out of its AIG investments, maybe. And a good old-fashioned literary magazine. Does it stand a chance in the internet world? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 14th of September. Good to have you here. If you had to pick just two words to sum up election 2010 so far, tax cuts would probably have to be pretty close to the top of that list. Specifically, whether to extend the Bush tax cuts for everybody, that's what the Republicans want, or just for people making less than $250,000 a year, as the White House and a lot of congressional Democrats want. You've probably heard the GOP argument in favor of extending those cuts, that raising taxes on anybody in a recession is going to cut off investment and stall an already stalled labor market. Fair enough as a political bullet point, but how do they know? We sent Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson on the toughest assignment of the day.
Those in favor of extending the Bush tax cuts for everyone often cite a research paper from the year 2000. One of the authors is the conservative economist Douglas Holtz Aiken. He says Treasury Department files show a connection between people's tax returns and their business activity.
And then you can look at changes in tax rates and the impact those changes had on capital investment.
And Holtz Aiken says the Bush tax cuts did spur investment. But he admits other factors, like financial crises or terrorist attacks, can make the effects of any tax change hard to pinpoint in the data.
It's not possible to trace a tax rate reduction to its impact on a specific part of the economy.
Len Berman agrees with Douglas Holtz Aiken on that one. Berman is a professor of public affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University.
And the problem for any of these questions is you need to isolate the effect of the tax cut from all the other things that are going on at the same time. There is a little bit of research on the effect of tax rates on business decisions, and that evidence is ambiguous.
In fact, some say the only thing spurring growth over the last decade was the rate on mortgages, not taxes. Bill Gale is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
We didn't have a great growth decade from 2001 to 2010 to begin with. And to the extent that we did get economic expansion, it didn't come from the areas of the economy that were subsidized by the Bush tax cuts.
Gale says it seems the debate that's going on now has a lot more to do with ideology than data. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The big financial reform package has been law for a couple of months now, but one of the key jobs in that whole thing is still vacant. The Obama administration can't quite figure out who it wants to run the powerful Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A White House spokesman said today the president will decide soon and that Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren is, quote, in the mix. It's not clear, though, that Warren could be approved by the Senate. So the administration is floating the idea of appointing her temporarily to get things up and running. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more now on what that might mean.
The Treasury Department has been hiring staff and setting up new offices, but so far all without a director. Elizabeth Warren is popular with consumer advocates and unions, but not with some lawmakers or bankers who say she's never worked in their industry and doesn't understand it. John Douglas is a former lawyer for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. He says if Warren is appointed without a Senate say-so, that could undermine financial reform.
The risk you run is, do you constantly have senators or others carping at rules or positions that might be taken with the argument that whoever it is that is leading the charge might not have gone through the proper political vetting and approval process.
Besides, says James Barth, author of The Great Savings and Loan Debacle, the confirmation process is a good way to build support for the reforms and find out how someone without any regulatory experience, like Warren, would shape the rules.
If she's the right person for that particular position, then why not let all members of the Senate ask her questions and see what she has to say? Perhaps the public will rally around her.
Still, Senate confirmation has its own risks. Given the strong political opposition to the consumer agency itself, John Douglas isn't sure anyone could be approved.
Maybe Mother Teresa, but Mother Teresa is no longer with us, so I suspect she would even attract a few negative votes as well.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Up until now, the reward for being a loyal customer at Ritz-Carlton Hotels has been, well, it's been its own reward. You get to spend the night at the Ritz. No freebies or incentive programs for the best customers. Just a staff anticipating your every move and your pillow fluffed just to your liking. But as Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio, it turns out that even the poshest clients of the Ritz are looking for a little payback.
Guests at the Ritz-Carlton expect to pay top dollar. In return, they expect the very best service and hopefully no bed bugs. But between online discounts and a raging recession, luxury hotels are a tough sell right now. Michelle Chang's an analyst at Morningstar.
You know, they really have to work harder to convince the consumer that it's worth X amount of dollars to be in a luxury hotel.
So the Ritz, part of Marriott, has begun a rewards program. A typical two-night stay starts at about $600 and is worth about 5,100 points. Around 50,000 points earns you a free night.
Honestly, I don't see a huge bargain here for travelers. I don't see a great deal.
That's blogger Mark Ashley at UpgradeTravelBetter.com.
I don't think it creates something that luxury travelers are going to really gravitate toward.
But the program may fill a few additional beds, and that might be just what the Ritz needs right now. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street didn't know what it needed today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I'm not a big one for anniversary stories, but I am obliged to note here that we are creeping up on 2 years since the financial industry came unhinged. Among the biggest of the too-big-to-fail crowd was the insurance company AIG. Still owes taxpayers about $120 billion. That's out of the $182 billion it originally got in bailout money. As a result, taxpayers own just shy of 80% of that company. Serena Ng reports today in the Wall Street Journal that the government is working on an exit plan. Serena, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you write this morning in the paper that the government has come up with a way to get itself out of AIG over time. But if I read it right, the first thing we have to do is get ourselves deeper into AIG. Is that right?
Yes. In some regards, you're right. But the government doesn't have to put more money into AIG, okay. Or at least that's the hope. The Treasury currently has something like $49 billion in what are known as preferred shares in AIG. And they're thinking of converting that into common shares, which are basically the kind of shares that most investors trade day to day, and then slowly selling that off to the public to recoup that $49 billion that the Treasury is owed by AIG.
Is there a timetable for this?
It's pretty well known that this process is going to take a few years because, you know, we're talking about a lot of money here. And obviously, a lot of that depends on whether investors are willing to buy AIG shares. Yeah. What they're talking about right now is potentially starting the process as early as the first half of next year. And hopefully, you know, by 2013 or 2014, we'll see the government get out. Right now, taxpayers are still owed roughly $125 billion. Some of it is going to be paid back from asset sales, and some of it is going to be paid back through, you know, the Treasury selling its shares.
You pointed out in your piece this morning, actually, that AIG does not have enough assets left to sell to be able to pay back the government in full.
That's right. They're in the process of selling two very large overseas life insurance companies. After they finish that, they still have that $49 billion that they owe Treasury. After selling off its main businesses, it's going to be a company that churn out profits of about $8 billion a year. Mm-hmm. And if they just use their earnings to repay the government, it could take 6 or 7 years. So the government wants to get out quickly, so they're trying to think of a way to get out through selling their shares to investors, which could actually take much less time than if AIG slowly earned its way back to repay the government.
So let me see if I have this straight, just to recap. If AIG can sell off all of its assets that it needs to raise the cash, and if the government can find buyers for all of its AIG shares, then maybe the government gets its money back. Sounds like a lot of ifs, a lot of maybes, a lot of hope. How realistic is any of this?
I mean, there are many, many risks to this. A lot of it also depends on how the stock market performs. I mean, if the stock market has another deep dive, pretty likely that this whole plan could be pushed back until market conditions recover. The other thing that AIG needs to do and needs to show and hasn't yet shown is, you know, really steady stream of consistent profits so that investors will feel comfortable enough to buy into the company. It's a lot easier said than done, but market conditions have recovered quite a bit. AIG's businesses, you know, have stabilized somewhat. So they are on the path to paying back, but obviously a lot of work still needs to be done.
Serena Ng with The Wall Street Journal on AIG and how the government might be able to get out of it. Serena, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The fall issue of the Paris Review hits newsstands tomorrow. The old standby literary magazine has a new editor this year, a new look, too. But the mission is still the same old one. The Paris Review was founded in 1953 by George Plimpton and company. Ever since, it's been all about fiction and poetry, not what you might call a financial recipe for success in a digital world. So we've called the review's new editor, Lauren Stein, to talk about how the magazine might survive in the age of blogs and page views. Lauren, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So I'll tell you, when I think of literary journals, you know, cutting edge is not the phrase that comes to mind. What are you guys doing to sort of bring this thing into the 21st century?
Well, we're doing a couple of things. One that's new is in June we started an online arts gazette called the Paris Review Daily that's already got about 200,000 readers. And we're talking to a few companies are interested in partnering with us to put out a digital edition. And I think that that's something we'll do. But the core of our business, as long as I'm editor, is going to be putting out a paper magazine. We call it The Paper. That's how it's always been referred to. And that is the thing that a literary magazine can do now. It has a special place that it didn't used to have in the culture, I think.
Why is that?
We want the reader to be absorbed. It's not a thing to skim. It's a thing to read and to really get lost in. And it's a refuge. Technologically, paper and ink are still the way to go. I don't know about you, but I still can't quite get absorbed in the gizmo that just delivered an email from my boss. And I certainly don't want to get an email from my boss while I'm reading a story.
Make me the elevator pitch for not the innovative things you guys want to do and the way you are and sort of have to bring parts of this magazine into the 21st century, but the business case for keeping it paper and ink and good design and solid writing.
There may not be a market for many, many literary magazines in America, but I'm quite sure that there's room enough for a couple of really great ones. If you can tell people honestly that by picking up your book, your magazine, They're going to get a sense of what's really going on in the culture. And if you can really promise that, and if you can deliver it, I don't think you have to do much else.
How many copies do you guys sell?
Our circulation right now is around 16,000, but, you know, I hope that will go up.
What's a realistic increase for you, do you think?
Several hundred thousand.
Really? A little pie in the sky?
Why not think big? There are so many more serious readers out there. People complain about declining readership. And then a book like Roberto Bolaño's 2666 comes out, or Jonathan Franzen's book, which I gather sold 35,000 copies the day it came out. These are serious works of fiction. These are masterpieces, and they're not easy. And people love them. People buy them. I think it's a real mistake to underestimate the American reading public, and I think publishers tend to.
Lauren Stein. He's the editor of the Paris Review. Lauren, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you so much.
Coming up, blogging is not about the money, until it is.
Basically, I put those banner ads up to maybe supplant the cost of a beer every now and then.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Industrials gave up 17 points, about 0.2%, finished at 10,526. The NASDAQ edged up 4 points, also about 0.2%, ended at 2289. The S&P 500 dipped, but less than a point, a fraction of a percent, closed at 1121. The Commerce Department said U.S. retailers saw their best sales in 5 months in August. Can you say back to school? Discounter JCPenney rang up nearly 7.5%. Electronics maven Best Buy powered up 6% today. Macy's put on nearly 3%. In earnings news, Kroger beat analyst expectations for the second quarter. The nation's largest grocery store chain said that's because it focused on customer service rather than cutting prices. Kroger shares loaded up 1%. Elsewhere, networking giant Cisco Systems announced it's planning to pay shareholders a dividend for the first time in its history, as in ever. Cisco stock rose 0.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service with the option to reach a human being at any time at 877-247-ALLY by pressing 0. By CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its monthly industrial production report. The House Committee on Homeland Security holds a hearing titled The Evolving Nature of Terrorism, 9 years after the 9/11 attacks. And aviation industry professionals gather in Iceland for an international conference on the effects of the volcanic eruption that took place in that country earlier this year. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. For all the talk of job cuts and unemployment in this country, we've got nothing on the layoffs announced in Havana, Cuba yesterday. President Raul Castro, Fidel's younger brother, said he is going to cut 500,000 public sector jobs and make most of them private sector jobs. It's a pretty clear acknowledgement that Cuba is having some financial difficulties, wasn't spared by the financial crisis, and it is still struggling to recover from hurricane damage 2 years ago. From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone reports.
Raul Castro has made some, quote, free market moves before, like turning vacant fields into private farms or letting barbers be their own bosses. But today's move would nearly double Cuba's private sector. That's real change, right?
We have to wait and see.
Andy Gomez is a senior fellow at the University of Miami's Cuba Institute. He says state workers make an average of $20 per month. If the government can't even afford to keep those employees on their payroll, this is an act of financial desperation.
In talking to some of the Cubans on the islands, they're very concerned in terms of what the layoffs means and what they're going to do next.
Uva de Aragon helps run the Cuban Research Institute at Florida International University. She says Cuba isn't exactly fertile ground for small businesses. There's no credit available, and between income and Social Security, taxes could be as high as 30%.
For a population that's been used to working for the state and having free medical and free education, that's a difficult pill to swallow.
But Philip Peters, a Cuba expert at the Lexington Institute in Virginia, welcomes the move. He says it could go as smoothly as the privatization of barbershops earlier this year.
Somebody's going to walk in there one day and say, gentlemen, this thing is now a cooperative. You're not going to get any more salary, but you're going to still work here. You're going to pay some tax, and you're going to keep the profits.
The 500,000 laid-off workers could have more competition soon. The Cuban government has indicated that deeper cuts may be on the way. From Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
All right, that's about enough out of me. Your turn now.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
Our weekly wrap last Friday afternoon left a lot of you down in the dumps. We had a pair of our regulars on, Heidi Moore and John Carney. Me too, of course. And I guess what really bugged a lot of you was my fault. I quoted White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs, who said, "This fall's election is going to turn on the question of whether people think we're better off now than we were in 2008. John and Heidi thought not, that in fact, a lot of Americans are feeling hopeless. That's what got to people, including Princeton, New Jersey's Trey Gillette.
In 2008, not only did we fear losing our jobs, but the entire economy was falling apart around us. We might not like Wall Street and the banks, and while unemployment is still too high, the recovery of these sectors gives us hope."
Ever the multimedia journalist, Heidi's been continuing that conversation with listeners on our website. It's marketplace.org if you want to check it out. Speaking of hope, there's a lot of it on Wall Street nowadays, multi-billion dollar mergers and acquisitions, and the, yes, hope that they mean better times ahead. Sandy Campbell of Siler City, North Carolina says, nuh-uh.
When will the talking heads quit touting all the merger and acquisition activity as actually benefiting the economy when it clearly only benefits a select few? The Wall Street investment banks, the shareholders, and that's about it.
We talk about budget deficits and trade gaps on this broadcast all the time. But our story last week on a trillion-dollar gap in pension funds left many of you fuming. Local, state, and federal governments are grappling with how to pay out on what are called defined benefit plans, even though tax revenues are down and the economy is too. Ellen Knopp from Greenwich Village, New York City, doesn't see a problem, provided people are smart.
There is no problem with defined benefit plans unless the state or employer puts pension money in risky investments or in the stock market. A prudent investor may still make a profit.
On the topic of profits, China is making a ton of them on rare earth metals. Beijing has pretty much cornered the market on minerals that are used in everything from smartphones to electric car batteries. Kyle Robinson from Queen Creek, Arizona, offers this suggestion.
So if our batteries, magnets, motors, etc. have so many rare earth elements, is it feasible to mine these elements from our waste? It would be nice to have other options than begging China for rare earths or sending all of our high-tech manufacturing to China.
Send your letters our way, please. Compliments or complaints. Marketplace.org is the website. The link you want is the one up in the top right-hand corner of that page. It says contact. There are, and this is just a rough count, approximately zillions of blogs out there. Only a tiny percentage of bloggers make anything close to a living at it. But if your blog does make money, and even if it doesn't, and if you happen to live in Philadelphia, the city wants a cut. To absolutely nobody's surprise, news of what quickly came to be called a blog tax circulated wildly in the blogosphere. And as with many things online, Joel Rose found out there is less to this story than meets the eye.
For a few days in August, Philadelphia was the laughingstock of the internet, as bloggers and even the mainstream media picked up the blog tax story and ran with it.
Philadelphia bloggers are all a-Twitter over a city business tax on their internet thoughts. If a blog
call it a blogging tax, some website bloggers are being sent letters from the city of Philadelphia demanding $300 for a
basically what they're doing is licensing freedom of speech.
The problem with the blog tax story is that Philadelphia doesn't actually have one.
There is no blog tax. The problem that the bloggers are encountering is that Philadelphia is not a welcoming place to be an entrepreneur, period.
Brett Mandel is a longtime tax reformer in Philadelphia. He says bloggers are discovering what small businesses in the city have complained about for decades. Basically, if you work for yourself in Philadelphia, you have to get what's known as a business privilege license, which costs $50 a year or $300 for a lifetime.
Philadelphia has a punishing tax structure. So whether you're trying to make a widget factory or whether you're trying to be the next Google, Philadelphia is going to tax you whether you make a profit or not, which is hard on startups.
Philadelphia isn't the only city that has this kind of fee, but it does seem to be more aggressive than most about enforcing it. The $300 license can be especially hard on the majority of bloggers, who say what they do is more like a hobby than a job.
My blog is a labor of love. It's not a business.
Sean Barry writes a music blog called Circle of Fits. He says he's made exactly $11 from the banner ads on his blog, not even enough to cover his web hosting.
I spend money to do what I do. I don't make any. Basically, I put those banner ads up to maybe supplant the cost of a beer every now and then.
Barry says he never got a letter from Philadelphia's tax office. In fact, all the noise about the so-called blog tax seems to be based on just one blogger who did hear from City Hall. Of course, that didn't stop the blogosphere from spreading the story far and wide, which in turn forced the city to do damage control.
So, to clarify, so if someone makes any kind of revenue from a blog, and they're based...
Last week, the city hosted a Bloggergate happy hour at a local bar to answer questions. Philly officials tried to seem sympathetic, but on the basic question, whether bloggers have to sign up for a business privilege license even if their blog is just a hobby, spokeswoman Andrea Menino wouldn't budge.
In our city, you know, unfortunately, the second you generate a dollar, we go after, and that's just the way our tax code is currently written.
That argument doesn't impress Andrew Baer. He's a lawyer who also writes a legal blog.
Regardless of what's on the books, any tax compliance agency, any Department of Revenue, has discretion in deciding who to go after and who not to. I would love to know whose decision it was to go after people earning $11 a year from Google AdSense and give this city this very public, very national black eye.
Tax reformers say it's a black eye Philadelphia richly deserves, just not for the reason you might think after reading the blogs. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, one that pretty much writes itself, to be honest with you. The Corn Refiners Association has just about had it with the campaign against high fructose corn syrup and how, in some studies, it has been linked to obesity. People have started not buying products that have high fructose anything listed in the ingredients. So refiners would like to suggest a new name. Today they applied to the Food and Drug Administration to get corn sugar approved as an alternative. Quote of the day, though, comes from Audrey Erickson. She's the president of the Corn Refiners Association. High fructose corn syrup, she says, has been highly disparaged and highly misunderstood. Who knew? You feel bad, right? Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow shed 17 points, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ edged up 4 points, also 0.2%. The S&P 500 dipped less than a point. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Rod Abid on our Morning Report crew. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this broadcast.
Just as war is too important to be left to the generals, it has turned out that finance is too important to be left to the financiers.
Director Charles Ferguson and his new documentary, Inside Job. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.